abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Thursday, October 31st, Halloween 2013. Tom Woods here. Today I'm joined by Rob Wolf by popular demand. I've had several requests for Rob Wolf. So today's the day. Now, let me tell you something, though. I'm going to be up front with you guys, right? I don't lie to you here on the Tom Woods Show. I actually talked to Rob Wolf about a month ago, right around the time I talked to Mark Sisson of the Primal Blueprint. And it was just a fluke of the way everybody's schedules worked out. So I thought, well, I'm going to get lynched by the listeners if I run Wolf right after Sisson. They're going to say, two diet and lifestyle people right in a row? What's going on here, Woods? I want variety on this show. So I held off in publishing my conversation with Rob Wolf for about a month. And so today is your lucky day. We're going to hear from Rob Wolf today. You're going to hear my chat with Rob Wolf. Rob Wolf is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Paleo Solution. And he also runs the heavily trafficked website, robwolf.com. Now, Rob is spelled with two B's, R-O-B-B, Wolf, robwolf.com. Now, I more or less associate myself with the Primal Blueprint. I have not been paleo, but I have some sympathy for it. And, of course, I'm a bit off the wagon on the Primal Blueprint just for a bunch of personal reasons, and I hope to hop back on as soon as I possibly can. But anyway, Rob's an interesting guy, and I thought it'd be good to have him on, and I had no idea how interesting and enjoyable he'd be. So let's turn right now to my conversation with Rob Wolf, which I hope you enjoy. Rob Wolf, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Huge honor to be here. Thank you.
Let's start off by asking you, very simply, in a nutshell, what is the Paleo Solution?
Well, you know, the Paleo Solution is this template that folks can use to look at nutrition, lifestyle, community, exercise, and use this to make some informed choices about how they might want to live their life. And you know, we're using this kind of evolutionary biology template and trying, you know, because there's so many disparate views out there. You know, maybe we should eat the Mediterranean diet, or maybe we should eat the Okinawan diet, and, you know, different things like that. And so what this evolutionary biology perspective does is it, you know, assumes that humans are kind of a part of nature, just like all the other critters in the world. And using that framework, then we can make some informed decisions about nutrition and exercise and photo period. And you know, I do a lot of work with the military and also police and fire. And what we find in those communities is a lot of problems related to, say, like photo period, shift work, and nobody's really understood why this is an issue until we've really got in and started looking at circadian rhythm and some of the evolutionary biology implications of sleep and disturbing sleep. And so that, you know, it's using this framework. So it's not just a diet, it's a kind of an overarching view to make some informed decisions. And you know, with that, then people can either take it or leave it. What we find is folks that are looking for performance improvements, you know, high-end athletes, and also people who are quite sick tend to be highly motivated to try something different. So that tends to be the two bookmarked, bracketed kind of populations that are very interested in this topic.
So what exactly is the type of food that somebody on the paleo, on a paleo regimen would consume?
Oh, gosh. You know, we could either do it inclusively or exclusively.
Why don't we do exclusively? That would be easier. What do you avoid?
You know, avoidance is you avoid grains, legumes, and dairy as a baseline. Now, I approach this in a very non-religious format, and I throw it out there as my greasy used car salesman pitch is, let's try this for 30 days, see how you look, feel, and perform, check biomarkers of health and disease, and then reevaluate at the end of that. And hopefully things have improved, and hopefully the return on investment is actually worth whatever suffering that's involved with that. You know, but what we find generally is that people end up feeling better, looking better, performing better, and they actually find that they like the nutrition and the way of eating, and they find some sort of 80-20 kind of thing where, you know, maybe Monday through Friday, they're pretty tight with this way of eating. And then the weekends, they maybe kick their heels up a little bit and have a little bit of fun and go off rails. And that seems to be a really nice, middle ground to find with this. If somebody is sick, then they don't get as much latitude. And that should make a ton of sense to folks. My background was in autoimmunity and cancer research. And probably the greatest impact I've had is actually folks with autoimmune disease. And so if you have multiple sclerosis, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, and you are facing potentially shortened lifespan, or at the very minimum, a very dramatically impacted lifestyle, then those folks may be highly motivated to be very, very strict on this. And what we found is it's quite successful in remedying those situations.
Now, I've had Mark Sisson on the Peter Schiff Show when I've been guest hosting, and I've had him on this program, and I'm familiar with the Primal Blueprint, and you guys are all friends, and it's an ecumenical community. But at the same time, there are differences, and just because I have imposed the primal stuff so heavily on my hapless audience, I think we should at least pause to note one major difference. And of course, you hit on it with the dairy. Now, are you saying that? Now, what exactly is so bad about dairy that with the exceptions that you make, that you maybe occasionally you go off the rails or something, but what is it about dairy that should make me want to avoid it altogether? Not just the 1% and the skim milk, but even whole milk, even raw milk. Why should it all be chucked?
You know, for a lot of people, they end up understanding, say, like the gluten reactivity issue, you know, that these proteins in wheat, rye, oats, barley, millet may cause some sort of a gastrointestinal inflammatory response, which then manifests in a systemic inflammatory response. And unfortunately, dairy has very similar effects as the grains do on quite a number of people. I would say that fermented dairy is better than non-fermented dairy. Raw fermented dairy is better yet. Things like butter and whole cream, particularly from grass-fed sources, are even better because they have a very low protein content. So, you know, the way that Mark approaches this is that he kind of allows an 80-20 approach with this right up front, and then if things aren't working well, then he tightens them up later. The way that I approach this is I really hold my folks' feet to the fire. Let's start with 30 days, assuming that we've got kind of a China syndrome meltdown, loads of problems. We assume everything is guilty, and then we slowly, reintroduction, we reintroduce dairy, maybe reintroduce some grains, and see how you react. And I've, you know, working in the clinical practices that I have, I've found that, you know, from my own experience, people tend to get very, very good results with this. And then because we've eliminated all of the major suspects, including dairy, then when we reintroduce them, we can see, do you react to it at all, or is it very minimal? And, you know, you could get away with 1 or 2 days a week, but not 3 or 4 days a week without getting, say, like a gastrointestinal distress some of the systemic inflammatory issues like joint inflammation and stuff like that. And this goes way, way, way beyond the lactase or lactose intolerance issue. This is actually dealing with the proteins themselves, which have some cross-reactivity in the GI tract, particularly when people are sensitive to, say, like gluten. Like, there's a high cross-reactivity of celiac individuals and non-celiac gluten intolerance and dairy.
Now, one of the arguments that people in the paleo community have made is that there are tremendous health benefits that come from observing a regimen like this. But then at the same time, though, people reading the news or listening to critics might be inclined to be a little bit concerned because of something like the China study. Now, can you weigh in on that and explain to people why, when they're being told that actually eating red meat, things of this sort, are actually terrible for them, and that you're giving them terrifyingly bad advice, why are these people wrong?
Well, you know, the China study is a great example of kind of politicization of science. And T. Colin Campbell is a brilliant guy. He's done some really amazing work. But early in his research, some of the salient research in the China study, like the bench, lab-based research, involve feeding mice, interestingly, both a toxin called aflatoxin, which is known to cause various types of cancer, and they were given a dairy derivative, a whey protein. And what they found, interestingly, though, is that a high protein intake from dairy caused greater morbidity and mortality in these mice in the long run, but actually it was preventative in developing cancer in the short run. And this is some of the information that, you know, kind of gets round filed in this whole story. And so what we understand pretty clearly is once you have cancer, cancer does a great job of metabolizing glucose. It also does a very good job of converting protein via this process called gluconeogenesis. It converts amino acids into glucose. Cancer is very robust in some ways, but it's also very metabolically limited. It can't use lipids. It can't really use proteins directly as a fuel source. It really, really relies on glucose, which that actually it should inform our eating just a little bit if we were to think a little bit about it. But it's interesting with the China study, Campbell never really published some of the earlier research that he had or has not made as much noise about it, that a high protein intake is actually preventative against developing cancer. But then, as we've all experienced, once you have cancer, it's a very difficult thing to manage. Like, we've been in the war on cancer since the Nixon era, and survivability, morbidity, mortality really hasn't improved all that much, except in some very specific situations, because cancer is effectively just a modified form of us. It's not as simple as taking an antibiotic and being able to shut down like a pathogenic bacteria. It's a modified form of us. And so our current chemotherapeutics are trying to poison something that is incredibly similar to us, but at the same time not kill us off. So that's been some of the challenges of cancer treatment in general. But, you know, it's interesting. The main story that we get from the government, the main story that we get from the media is that we should be eating a low-fat, high-carb, you know, more or less vegan-based diet, which is fascinating from a resource sustainability issue. That doesn't represent any type of a vibrant ecosystem anywhere on the planet. Anywhere that we look, we see plants and animals interacting in both a trophic kind of format in which plants convert sunlight into carbohydrates and other you know substrates, and then animals eat those plants, and then other animals eat the animals, and this whole cycle goes on and on. But it's fascinating that the push is to produce a very lopsided, unsustainable food production story, and something that really doesn't jive at all with what anthropology, evolutionary biology, or really a good analysis of the data would tell us.
Now, Rob, your book, The Paleo Solution, was a New York Times bestseller, and it's still selling pretty strongly. I mean, of course, as authors, you and I know that when you have a best-selling book, it sells pretty well, but if it's not a fiction title that's promoted by Oprah, it doesn't sell as well as everybody assumes it sells. So right. Everybody thinks that you and I are, you know, have $80 million in the bank, and why aren't we bigger philanthropists with all of the money bags we've got? But the fact is, you are one of the most important names attached to this movement, both with the writing that you've done, and also now you have the Paleo Solution podcast. You must get a lot of testimonials from people who say, you know, I started listening to you and I was skeptical, and then I did it, and now, well, what? What follows that? What do they tell you?
Gosh, you know, we've had, I think some of the most fascinating stuff that we've had are folks that had some really well-documented pathology. They had multiple sclerosis, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis. They show, you know, like we've had a number of folks that had clear imaging, MRIs showing brain lesions, showing lesions in the central nervous system before eating paleo, going paleo for 30 to 90 days, and then showing a reversal in these lesions, and then more importantly, showing a complete reversal in the symptomology that they had. And, you know, we see antinuclear antibodies in rheumatoid arthritis, the titer being quite high, which indicates that the body, you know, I don't know if folks are aware of this, but an autoimmune condition is when our own immune system thinks that tissues in our body are foreign invaders and it starts attacking our own tissues. And it can attack anything from the heart, the lungs, the brain, you know, anything is really fair game. And we are very, very poorly equipped at treating these conditions. One of the main things that is done is putting people on immunosuppressants, but then when you suppress the immune system, then you're in a situation that in which you're at high likelihood of the same complications that we see in HIV/AIDS, fungal infections, sarcoma, a number of things like that. And so, you know, we really don't have a good way to treat these things. And I think to the degree that my book has remained very, very successful, our podcast has bounced between number one and number five on iTunes for 3 years, is just that we've thrown this idea out to folks and just asked them, please try it. And then good, bad, or indifferent, please tell us what your results have been so that we can refine the technology, refine the message, so that we can help more people. We did kind of a back of the envelope survey of folks who had bought my book, and I give all of the information in the book away for free on my website. I've got shopping and food guides. I have quick start guides. I go into much more detail in the book, but basically I give all of the information that's in the book, I give that away for free. And what we found is about 60 to 70% of the people buying the book had already downloaded all the free material, got all the results that they were probably ever going to get, you know, and it was very, very good, very impressive for them. And then just to pay it forward, they actually went and bought like 10 copies of my book. And so it's been this interesting kind of freemium model of, if I can give this thing away to enough people and just get them to try it, I will make tons of money helping people be healthier.
Well, I don't know about you, but I always feel people who buy 10 copies of my book are really models for all mankind to,
exactly,
to emulate.
Yes.
So the website is robwolf.com with two Bs, R-O-B-B, robwolf.com. Is that the website you're talking
Correct.
About?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I do want to ask, so you've got a lot of people who are willing to try this out, you know, give it a shot, and, you know, worst that can happen is you just don't like it, and then, you know, what can I say? But what's the biggest trouble, biggest stumbling block to getting people to do it in the first place? When you're spelling out what you are convinced are all the benefits, what's the problem giving them that initial push? Why won't they do it? Why do they resist?
Well, you know, I would say, you know, if we had 100 people and I you know, gave folks a little bit of a talk on this topic and, you know, I said, hey, do you folks want to try this for 30 days? 50% of those folks would say, yeah, I'll give it a shot, and they would be in. They, you know, they're just they're excited, they're engaged, they're willing to give it a shot. I don't need to bend their arm. They're going to jump in and try this thing on. I kind of equate it to putting on a sweater or a pair of jeans. They'll try it on, see if they look good in it, and, you know, they kind of go from there. Of the remaining 50%, about half of those people require a lot of arm bending, cajoling. They will go surf the internet and they'll bring up things like the China study and, you know, what about the My Pyramid and gee whiz, this dietitian that is my sister's aunt's niece's friend, you know, told me that red meat would kill me. But, you know, those folks with some education and some arm bending and cajoling and maybe even a little bit of a public shaming, they may eventually come around. And then there's a kernel of about 25% of the population that even if they are sick, not feeling good, they have tons of problems. They are the people that, you know, have been a pack-a-day smoker their whole life. They get the tracheotomy deal, and they are smoking through the trachea. Like, there is no saving those folks. So I find that there's a large chunk of the population that is actually very willing to give this a shot. And then a smaller chunk that, with a little bit of arm bending and cajoling, they will get in and try it. And again, you know, I haven't had a TV show. I haven't had a huge marketing budget behind this, but the website gets tons of traffic. The show does well. The book remains, you know, after being out for 3 years, is still selling very, very well. And it's just because this success begets success. But there is a kernel of folks that no amount of effort on my part is ever really going to bring them in, or it's a very diminishing returns. Like, I would have to try incredibly hard to get 1 or 2 more percent of those folks. And I just really don't have the time or the wherewithal to do that. I try to be a high velocity, low drag kind of person and get this message out to as many people as I can, as quickly as I can. And the smart, entrepreneurial people will give it a shot, and it'll either work for them or it won't. I think generally it does. And that's part of the success of the whole story. But I haven't spent a ton of time trying to convince the folks that are convinced that it's not going to work. I say, okay, that's fine. I hope that your insurance, health insurance, life insurance, is in a different tranche than mine,
right?
Because I'm gonna cost less and live longer than you
well,
are.
So you know what? In a way, it's like the the molasses you can get caught in when you're when you get into like a Facebook or internet argument with somebody in a comment box, and you can spend all day arguing with somebody and you make zero progress. You think of all the good I could have done in this day if I had just focused my energy on people with open minds, and there are plenty of them out there. A couple more things I want to ask you. I mean, as a fellow author, I'm fascinated by somebody because I've had a couple of New York Times bestsellers too, but the circumstances have to be just right. I mean, because I've had books that I thought were going to take off, and they didn't really do so well. It's always hard, and books are very hard to sell, because every year there's something like 200,000 new titles that come out onto the market. How are you going to get your book out there to distinguish itself? How do you account for the fact that your first book is a New York Times bestseller?
Gosh, I guess to some degree it's a 15-year-long overnight success. Like I've just been chopping wood, carrying water on this topic for a long time. Like my first exposure to this whole topic was in 1998, and at that time there were maybe a couple of hundred, maybe a few thousand people in the world that if you said paleo diet, they would have any understanding of what you were talking about. And typically it was a researcher, an anthropologist, evolutionary biologist, you know, something like that. Or maybe if there were a few physicians like Boyd Eaton, who wrote both a book and a piece that made it into the New England Journal of Medicine back in 1986. But it was a very, very small group of folks. And I started writing about this stuff, blogging about it. I was involved in the very early iterations of this CrossFit strength and conditioning movement. And I did their nutrition search for a number of years. And so I started just broadcasting this message, and Lauren Cordain, who's my mentor, and he's really, regarded as kind of the godfather of the whole paleo diet concept. He and I have talked about this being almost like SETI in reverse, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Instead of a big parabolic dish listening to the universe, we were actually trying to beam this message out to, you know, the world and see if anybody received it and what their results were, and then, you know, kind of creating some interface around that. But I think that we had some timing that was well placed with regards to the internet and social media and the ability for people to do some N equals one experimentation, just some self-experimentation, see how things worked, communicate with the folks that were broadcasting the message. And then people could read that and make some objective opinions out of it and read the literature as it became available. And I think that whenever we see a concept that works, that creates community, that makes people's lives better, I think that we have the potential for it to become very sticky and for it to perpetuate itself. And so I think that, you know, I had worked very long and hard answering literally thousands of forum questions and blog questions, you know, people coming to my website, and had created a rather large grassroots following. And those people were very, very endeared to me and really worked hard to make the book successful.
Now, let me ask you something that might, I don't know, maybe it won't endear them to you quite as much, but I can't help asking this because, of course, what you're talking about runs counter to, well, you know, your friend's aunt's neighbor who happens to be a dietitian or whatever, but it also runs counter to all the government guidelines and the official food pyramid with all the grains at the bottom and the 11 servings a day and all that. So is there, if I may ask, a libertarian streak in Rob Wolf?
Oh man, yeah, about a mile wide, and I have some friends in this scene who have not come out of the closet yet. We won't name names. Both you and I know.
We know who we're talking about.
Yeah, but we won't out them yet. And you know, the challenge, and it's interesting. Like I've been back and forth on this thing because part of me and part of the recommendation that I've received from people who are more successful than I am, and you know, Rob, keep your head down. You beat a good drum on this nutrition thing, but don't get into the politics. Don't get out in the weeds with this stuff. But the challenge that I've had is that the very system that we are in is fundamentally broken. Like the part of the reason why our, you know, people make bad food decisions is primarily economics based. We subsidize the production of grains. Those grains then get processed into very hyper palatable, very tasty, highly unhealthy foods. And then they appear to be cheaper than apples and oranges and, you know, pork loin and whatnot, because it's a false economy.
Right.
And unless we fix that, you know, you can't, and this is something that I think both liberals, and kind of the religious right you can only guilt people into so much new action. There's a very small number of people who will change behavior out of guilt. There's an enormous number of people who would change behavior out of economic circumstance. And so this is where tackling, you know, the fundamental food production story, the fundamental story of like a third party healthcare system that has is fraught with moral hazard, that doesn't produce accountability, that you know has all kinds of ways for people to just fundamentally not be accountable. And all of these things are very intimately tied together. Our food production, the healthcare system, the way that we tie all this stuff into the government. And it, at some point, I just felt like I was just going to be the little Dutch boy with the fingers in the dike, you know, like I would plug a hole and another would pop up, and I would plug a hole and another would pop up. And the only way that we're really legitimately going to address this story is by a systemic overhaul. But this does freak a number of the people who follow me. It just freaks them out because they are not comfortable with this idea of markets, improving healthcare, improving our food supply. But, you know, even right now, it's very interesting as we're recording this. You know, we're still in this government shutdown. We're printing money like crazy. You know, we have a very fragile food production system. And part of what I've been advocating for is a decentralized, non-government interventioned food production story that would survive an oil crisis. It would survive all kinds of ups and downs in currency debasement. Because it isn't centrally planned. And it's slowly this idea is getting out there. And I've actually been getting some reach out from some large Fortune 500 companies. And I'm actually working on a project here in the Reno, Nevada, where we did a risk assessment program with the Reno Police, Reno Fire, where we found their high-risk police and firefighters who were at high risk of cardiovascular disease, put them on a low-carb paleo diet, and saved the city of Reno just with the pilot study $22 million. And now we're scaling this up and taking it hopefully national and international. But the, you know, these market-based forces, when you look at kind of libertarian market-based analysis of economics, this really is the way that the world works. This is the way, and it may make people mad or it may make them feel warm inside, but it's just kind of the way the world works. And then on this other piece, this evolutionary biology piece is the way that nature works. And when we meld these things together, it's not opinion. It's actually working, you know, with the way that nature functions, economics and evolution. Some people aren't comfortable with different elements of that. I can sympathize with it. But if we're going to fix what ails us, I really think that we need to embrace both of those concepts and ride those ponies till the legs fall off of them.
I appreciate your time. As I say, well, sometime down the road when people have, you know, they need to have another Rob Wolf fix, we'll have plenty of stuff to talk about. So I appreciate your time. Thanks again.
Huge honor being on the show. Thank you.
All right, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that chat with Rob Wolf, whom I hope you will visit at robwolf.com, robwolf.com. And check out The Paleo Solution, his New York Times bestseller. All right. Thanks again, you guys, for listening in, for checking out libertyclassroom.com and using the coupon code SHOW in all caps. Helps keep the show going. And thanks also for making your Amazon purchases by first visiting tomwoodsradio.com, because then at no cost to you, you can help me keep this office and keep things going here on the show. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.